This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I just want to talk today about two quite unique characteristics of color as a sensed feature of things. I'll try and say one or two things that link to the earlier presentations, because I was struck as I was listening to them how connections could be made. My own presentation is somewhat abstract, as you'll see, but I'll try and connect them. So first I want to talk about the first property I want to talk about is the almost unique aesthetic interest in color. So here's a painting by Josef Albers called Homage to the Square. The title's a bit wry because the square's not doing a whole lot of work there. So, here's Homage to the Square. Right? Unless he meant that the color was paying homage to the square by decorating it or something, but making it more interesting or something. So that's not terribly terribly interesting, you would think. But of course, a lot of artists have played with color and form, with color doing almost all the work. So here's Mark Rothko. A lot of people report, apropos Richard's remark about attention, that Rothko, in fact, does the opposite to you. It sort of puts you into a zone of no attention, a sort of a reverie. So color has that, has both sorts of functions, both of drawing attention and also of zoning you out into a non-attentive state. There's Barnett Newman. Here's Gerhard Richter, who played with a lot of different colors. He has a formula to randomize the appearance of colors in these. I believe that's 4,096 colors, if I'm not mistaken, and that's 15 times 12, whatever that is, 225. That's not right. Anyway, and here he reproduced his work on this magnificent south transept window in Cologne. Here's Damien Hirst. Blake Gopnik says something very strange. Hirst's spots give an atom's eye view of how the world really is. Atoms aren't colored, so that's a sort of a strange thing for him to have said. So not certainly doesn't give us an atom's view of color, because as Democritus famously said, by convention hot, by convention cold, by convention colored, but in reality atoms and the void. So stripes and squares and dots have no, or I shouldn't say no, but relatively little interest in themselves. But colors, just all by themselves, seem to have a great deal. And one question you might ask is, why should that be? I mean, why should you be fascinated by color, though, as all three previous speakers, no, actually, Nicole, I'll come back to you in a second, but obviously there's a great deal of fascination, and one question that you might ask is why. By the way, I'm not going to answer that question, though I'll point you in some direction that's relevant, or at least seems to me to be relevant. Okay, so here's Albers. Albers writes in this strange style where he breaks things up into lines as if they were poetry, and quite often it's not poetry at all, but here we go. In musical composition, he says, so long as we hear merely single notes, we do not hear music. We're able to hear a single tone, but we almost never, that is without special devices, see a single color. He said he thinks that you never, when you're looking at that Mark Rothko black, you're not seeing a single color, according to him, unconnected and unrelated to other colors. As a consequence, this proves for the reading of color what Kandinsky often demanded for the reading of art, What counts is not the what, but the how. Sort of puzzling remark, but the idea is that you can present a tone all by itself, you can't present a color all by itself. So you might think that you're looking at a simple color, but according to Albers, you never are, except in very strange circumstances. So we get pleasure from looking at monochrome expanses and simple combinations of colors, and that pleasure is just the pleasure of looking, or it could be the displeasure, but the point is that it's not something that is, goes beyond the mere looking of it. But we do not get corresponding pleasure from sensing simple tones or tastes or even, I would argue, touches. Any pleasure we get from tones or tastes or touches is linked to consuming something or being in a positive or negative emotional state, not the pleasure of simply expressing it. So there's a lot of argument in philosophy about whether touch, for instance, could be aesthetic. And the argument is no, because even though you might think you're enjoying the mere experience of touch, you're in fact, there's something more that's involved in it, which is goes beyond the experience. Okay, so that's one characteristic of color, namely that it's aesthetically very rich. By contrast, it's informationally extremely poor, as I'll try to argue now. So there is a use, for color as far as information is concerned, and that use is to identify objects. So here are people who identify their suitcases by strapping little colored bands on them, very effective. But what does color tell you about an object other than which object it is? Right? It tells you, I will argue in a minute, nothing about which kind of, or it tells you a bit about what color, what kind of object is. Not really, because what color does is to enable us to identify membership in a class, but it doesn't tell you very much about that class. So color can tell you about the condition of something. It can tell you bruises, abrasions. It can tell you that somebody's in an emotional state. That's because these bruises and abrasions and emotions have a color which enables you to classify them. But the fact that a bruise hurts or that an abrasion was the result of a cut or that somebody's darkening is a sign of emotion, that is not something that the color tells you. It's something that is associated with the class which the color helps to identify. So again, ripe versus unripe fruit, you have to learn fruit by fruit what color indicates ripeness. It's not as if red is always ripe and green is always unripe. There are fruit for which this is not the case. So again, all that happens is that you identify a class and then you associate with these classes ad hoc properties such as the above. This is very true, obviously, of racial color, right? I mean, all it does is to put you in a class. It doesn't tell you anything about the actual intrinsic properties of that class. So you know that red or orange, if in India it's orange, in Mexico it's red, mango is ripe, but this doesn't generalize to pears and certainly doesn't generalize to London buses. London buses are red but not ripe. And you don't even know that two red objects have the same frequency profile. Even that is not the case. A phenomenon known as metamerism, which just doesn't exist with respect to sounds. With sounds, at least you know what the frequency profile is. In the case of color, you don't. So, texture and shape tell you about the physical properties of things. So, for example, you know that this sphere, also by Gerhard Richter, by the way, you know certain things about it just by looking at it. What do you know? You know that it can be rolled, and everything else of this shape can be rolled. contrast the case of color, where you could not make that kind of generalization. You know that it's smooth and cool to touch, like everything else that is shiny and metallic. That's an association. It cannot be stacked on any other sphere. You can't just make a stack of spheres. Vision tells you all of the above, even though the things that we're talking about, like rolling and so on and so forth, are not visual properties. So the spatial properties revealed by vision have physical reality. The sphere, that has physical reality, which is able to tell you certain things about it, namely that it can be rolled and so on and so forth. But color properties don't reveal physical reality, and thus they don't generalize, which they're hooks for generalization, because you can put things in a class and then associate properties with it. The hooks in that way are sometimes very misleading hooks, but they don't generalize in virtue of their own nature. Okay, so why is all of this the case? So color information is extracted from three overlapping broadband cells in the eye. This one is just for brightness, the so-called rod, and it doesn't work during the day. Only works in low illumination situations. So the three colors which are important, the three cells which are important for color are the long wave, the medium wave, and the short wave cones. And as you see, these cones overlap a lot, including, for instance, the long and the medium. As you see, the long, they're not even very well shaped. The long one has this rising tail, which I'll talk about more in a second. So the L cone, take one example, can't distinguish between a weak cell of roughly 560 nanometers and a rather strong light. These are sensitivity cones, so a strong one will produce as much of a response here as a weak one here. So it tells you very little about the intrinsic color of the light that's hitting it. And you might ask, well, given that this information is so little, right, why not have more? Why don't we have 5 cone cells? Why don't we have 10 cone cells? You know, with audition, you essentially have one receptor per frequency band, you know, because the ear is shaped that way. But in vision, you don't. Why is that? And the reason is that vision isn't primarily a chromatic modality. What vision's job is to give you a map of objects in space. So if you had more cones cells dedicated to getting chromatic information, you would have to pack them into the same location in the eye, and as a consequence, you'd make the eye much less acute with respect to spatial differences. And the job of vision is primarily spatial, not chromatic. So among mammals, very few species have color vision at all. Okay, notice this rising tail of the L cone. That accounts for why violet, which is at the opposite end of the spectrum than red, nonetheless has a reddish tinge to it, right? Because it's excited by those low frequencies. How am I doing for time? Am I okay? Okay, so you can map the colors depending on how they affect the cone cells. These are 2 cone cells. And this is how the colors of the spectrum, which are at the end of the boundary of that that shape, you can see that. This measures how the color affects the cones. Note that the shape of this completely distorts the physical reality that underlies. So for instance, the mid-spectrum occupies a lot of space there. The ends of the spectrum occupy a lot less space. And the ends of the spectrum are closer to one another than each of them is to the middle. So the whole thing has become quite distorted as far as physical reality is concerned. But there's a process called opponent processing, which tries to at least get more information out in a legible form. So for example, this very squished end of the blue corner, opponent processing, what it does is to try and subtract x from y. And when it subtracts x from y, it decompresses that corner just a bit. It decompresses it because, as you notice, while this one, the y, the short one, is increasing, this one is decreasing. It's going further back. And as a result, you can x minus y, it decompresses a little bit with respect to x plus or x and y. So what do you get there? You get something like that. Opponent processing, this sort of maximizes the legibility of color, but that's all it does. It doesn't increase informational content at all. The structural layout is totally out of correspondence with the real properties of color. By the way, it's an interesting thing, and maybe I'll say something about this afternoon. Skin color all occurs in just this little area here, right, and towards the black end. The black-white is this way. So skin color occurs in little 1/8. So as a friend of mine wrote to me recently, I was at a summer school in Greece, and there are a number of shades of brown represented there, and we were all sort of childishly comparing. You darker? Am I darker? And there was this Lebanese woman who said that she had always thought of herself as a white Lebanese, which was pretty clearly nothing like that. One thing that we came to realize was really we're all just different shades of orange. Question is whether we're darker or lighter. Anyway, so these things are not real. And recall Alba's quoting Kandinsky, it's a how, not a what. Okay, so here's the idea that uniquely among sensory properties, uniquely, color and intercolor structural relations correspond to nothing real. Alba's interactions of colors are simple artifacts of the brain's processing of color. So color's unique in two ways. First of all, it's informationally uniquely poor. And secondly, it's aesthetically uniquely rich. And you might ask whether there's any connection between those two facts. So, very quickly, because I really don't want to say very much about this, but I'm going to just throw out a suggestion. So Kant rightly held that aesthetic pleasure is pleasure in contemplating something, in this case, looking at color. It's not quite aside from any pleasure derived from consuming it. Need-based consumption, such as gustatory or sexual pleasure, are typically not considered aesthetic because they're both too closely tied to the pleasure of consumption. Both recede when consumption has reached its natural end. So when the value of consumption is highly salient, the value of contemplation recedes. Suggestion. When we contemplate shapes and tones, we naturally consume the information that resides in them. Aesthetic pleasure in these things comes only from their arrangement and interactions. And color carries little information. Free-floating color, in fact, carries no information. Contemplating it is informationally disinterested. So when we dwell on the beauty of color, because we are not distracted by the information that it contains. Thank you.